jobs that come to be, and people gather around. They have all what they can bring, and nobody went with that. Other than a sound sing, the revolution starts now.
Good afternoon and welcome to Indie Media Live, one of the most progressive half hours on the radio because we have no corporate sponsorship and no corporate control. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and I'm here every Tuesday introducing you to people who are passionately involved in the issues and causes that directly affect you and your family. We have a great show for you today. Professor Gary Francione is with us. He is going to be talking about his new book, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. But before we get to that, I want to bring you a couple of important event announcements. On Sunday, March the 13th, there will be a fundraiser for Bradley Manning's defense. It will be held at Busboys and Poets in Washington, 2021 14th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Specialist Manning is accused of providing classified documents to WikiLeaks and is being held at Quantico Marine Base in Stafford, Virginia. If you'd like more information about this event, www.busboysandpoets.com. Or you can give them a call, 202-387-7638. We will have all of this information posted also on our blog, indiemedialive.blogspot.com. I would like to tell you also that on Saturday, March the 19th, there will be a rally for peace at noon at Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., and a march on the White House following on the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq as the occupation and U.S. war-making continue unabated. The Veterans for Peace and StopTheseWars.org are holding another massive veteran-led civil resistance. This is going to take place at noon, and speakers for the event will include Ralph Nader, Chris Hedges, and Anne Wright. Some of the organizations that are involved include Answer Coalition, Code Pink, Peace Action, War Crimes Times. You can find out more about all of this on our blog, indiemedialive.blogspot.com, or on the websites of some of these organizations. So now I'd like to introduce you to Gary Francione. It's wonderful to have him back with us today. Gary is the Distinguished Professor of Law and the Nicholas DeBee Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law. He is a proponent, a leading philosopher of animal rights theory. So, Gary, thank you so much for being here.
I'm delighted.
After 37 years of not eating meat, about 4 years ago, I happened to hear you on being interviewed on the radio by Bob Linden on his radio show Go Vegan, and you explained the moral position of veganism and changed my life. And so I'm just so grateful to you for being here with us today on the radio, my radio show.
That's interesting because, you know, you sort of prove a point I've been making for a long time, which is you can have people who are really concerned about this issue, and if you tell them that vegetarianism is something that really is sort of a meaningful moral step to take, what people will do is they'll take that step, and then they won't go any further because they'll continue to sort of believe that there's this artificial distinction between meat and eggs and dairy products and other sorts of animal foods. So I think, in a sense, you're sort of a perfect example of, it's not that people go vegetarian and then they go vegan, so therefore vegetarianism is a necessary step. It's, for many, many people, it's the final step until somebody really sort of brings to them the argument in favor of veganism.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful to you for doing that. And we're going to be talking today about that very argument. We are going to be looking specifically at your new book, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. You and Robert Garner our back and forthing in this book. It's interesting. Robert Garner is also a vegan. You ask him that in the book, and he fesses up to that. But there are such different approaches. And I thoroughly enjoyed this read, and I thank you for putting this book together. I would like to comment, first of all, about the fact that you show such respect throughout the book for those who have the new welfarist position.
Yeah, you know, I it's interesting because my position engenders such a terribly negative reaction from some folks, and because they interpret the statement of the argument to be some sort of negative comment about them. And I'm not doing that. What I'm trying to do in the book is to say, look, I understand that you have views and beliefs that you hold sincerely, and I sincerely believe they're wrong, and here's why I believe they're wrong. But I'm not questioning. I really actually made a point in the book, the outset of the book, to say I'm not questioning these folks, and I'm not questioning their sincerity. I just think that the direction in which they're going is the wrong direction, and I think that, you know, we need to have debate and discussion about this. And I'm really very disappointed because the folks who do promote the new welfarist approach, by and large, will not discuss these issues. They won't debate them. They won't discuss them. They basically declare them to be the truth, and they get very upset about anybody who disagrees with them, and they don't really engage debate or discussion, and that's a shame. And I think that at least some of them may interpret my critique as being a statement about them personally, and I really wish they wouldn't, because I go out of my way to say it's not. I mean, it's people can hold all sorts of views, and they can hold them sincerely, and they can hold them in good faith, but they can still be wrong.
And I was struck by your compassion for these people as well throughout the book, so I thank you for that.
Well, you know what, Rebecca, I'm delighted that that came through. I can't tell you how happy I am that that came through to you and that you made that observation. That's really important to me because I think it's an area where there's a lot of contentiousness and where any sort of criticism just really gets misinterpreted and heard in ways in which it's not intended.
Yeah, because we're all animals, right?
Right, exactly.
We all deserve to be treated with compassion.
That's right.
And that being said, I do have to say that another observation that I made in reading the book is that the new welfarist argument just doesn't hold water.
Well, you know, look, the people don't really understand. The first part of the book, I try to explore the idea that many people promote or believe in. That is this idea that, well, what's the difference? What's the big deal? You know, we're all animal people. Why can't we all get along? And the answer is, well, because we have very different views, fundamental differences in how we think about these issues. And so what I try to do in my portion, the way the book is divided, I make the abolitionist argument in the first part of the book. Robert Garner, who is a professor of political theory at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom, he makes an argument in the second part of the book arguing for welfare regulation. And in the third part of the book, we actually debate, we engage each other and go back and forth in sort of a question and answer format. And what I try to do in the first part of the book is to say, look, there's a huge difference between the abolitionist approach and what I call the new welfarist approach, in that all versions of welfare, going back 200 years ago to the commencement or the emergence of the welfarist theory, are based on the notion that animals don't really have an interest in continuing to live. They don't have an interest in their lives. They only have an interest in not suffering. So if that's empirically true, then the goal is to try to reduce suffering and to try to make sure that slaughter is as humane as possible, because animals don't really care about their lives, they just care about not suffering. So as long as they don't suffer too much, we're not really engaging in anything that's particularly morally wrong. That is the welfarist position. That's the new welfarist position. It explains a lot of the behavior that, and a lot of the positions that organizations that organizations take. And, you know, we see major theorists in the movement taking the position that animals don't have an interest in their lives. They only have an interest in not suffering. So if we raise them humanely and kill them humanely, we haven't really done anything wrong. And I argue that is just that's a speciesist position, in that it assumes that the only way that you can have an interest in continuing to live is to have a human-like sense of self-awareness. And I think that that is a speciesist position. I have no doubt that non-human animals think differently about their lives from the way that I think about my life or the way that you think about your life, because we use language and we think in a particular way about those notions because of the concepts that we have. But that does not mean that animals don't have an interest in their lives. In the second part of the book, so I start off by saying there's a huge difference between the welfarist position, which rests on this notion that animals don't have an interest in continuing to live, and it explains, by the way, why many of the large organizations take the position that it really doesn't matter whether you're promoting cage-free eggs or you're a vegan or you're promoting gestation crate-free pork or whatever, because these are all just ways of reducing suffering. And as I point out in the book, veganism is not a way of reducing suffering alone. It's a way of expressing the notion that we have obligations of justice to non-human animals, that it really doesn't matter how humanely we exploit them. We have no business, we cannot justify exploiting them at all. In the second part of the book, I argue that even if you think welfare reform is a good idea, even if you think that it's a good idea, it doesn't work because animals are economic commodities. And by and large, the welfare regulations that we have, whether they're imposed by law or whether they're accepted voluntarily by industry, basically increase production efficiency, because the bottom line is that neither industry nor the law is going to require that animal institutional users impose welfare standards that are not cost effective, because that raises the price of these products. And in a world of what we might loosely call free trade, in a world in which there are international markets, if the demand for the lower welfare product continues, then you won't be able to keep that out of the market, and it'll cause market chaos. So the bottom line is, if you look at the animal welfare reforms that we have and that are being proposed, you will see that these are simply things that make increase production efficiency, and don't, you know, it's not that they're imposing costs on animal production, which causes the products to increase in price so that demand goes down. That's not happening at all. The third point I make is that new welfarists frequently say, well, abolitionists are utopian, and they're simply not realistic. They have no real program for change. And the answer is yes, we do. It's called unequivocal abolitionist vegan education. It's teaching people about veganism. Creative nonviolent vegan education is an extremely effective form of activism. Indeed, I think becoming a vegan is the most important activist step that an individual can take. Being a vegan is expressing your view that you are not going to participate in violence against non-humans. It expresses your view about our obligations of justice. And to the extent that you persuade other people of your position, you cause demand to go down. You build a political movement of nonviolence that excludes animals from the realm of things that we can exploit. And we set a predicate for real, sustained change. And so I think that's a much better program for change than a realistic program for change than promoting cage-free eggs or gassed chickens or any of these other sorts of things, which basically do nothing more than increase production efficiency. Industry is going to do that stuff anyway. We don't need all of these expensive campaigns for industry to do those things. These are things industry is transitioning toward anyway for economic reasons. And the bottom line is, it simply makes people feel better about animal exploitation. And that's another issue I discuss in the book. Now, having said that, Robert disagrees with me in a lot of ways, so people should read the book and make judgments about whether, you know, my arguments are better than his.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Indie Media Live on WRIR. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and I'm having a very enlightening conversation with Gary Francione, one of the authors of The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. Gary, I think my most profound takeaway from the book was that paradigm-shifting idea of the moral personhood of animals.
Yes, I mean, look, animals are either persons or they're things. We live in a binary world. There's no such thing as like quasi-persons or things plus or whatever. That was something I discussed in an earlier book I wrote, that, you know, we live in a world in which you have persons or things. Now most of the things that we have, my chair, my computer, my printer, I'm just looking around my office here, these are things. They're not part of the moral community because they don't have any sorts of interests. Animals, unlike chairs and computers and printers, have interests. They have preferences, desires, or wants. So even though they're property, they're a particular sort of property. But they are presently classified as things. As far as the law is concerned, they are things. And what I'm arguing is they ought not to be things. They ought to be regarded as non-human persons, as members of the moral community, as beings with respect to whom, when we inflict suffering or death, we need to provide a coherent moral justification. And there may be circumstances in which people think that the moral justification can be met. Next Tuesday night, I'm going to be debating somebody who does animal experimentation at UCLA. I'm going to be debating him at Rutgers, and he takes the position that we get certain benefits from animal experimentation, and therefore imposing suffering and death on animals is justified. Now, I'm going to argue with him and explain to him why I think that's not the case, but put aside the animals used for vivisection, because in the end, that's a very small number of animals. I don't think you should use any animals for vivisection. Let me make that clear. Not one rat, not one animal, any species. I don't believe in vivisection at all. However, I'm talking about the 56 billion animals a year, not counting fish, that we're eating. And we have no good reason other than the fact that they taste good to inflict pain, suffering, and death on those 56 billion animals, not counting fish. So my view is that, you know, if animals are non-human persons, then the very least that we owe them is when we inflict suffering and death on them, we have got to come up with a coherent moral justification which makes that okay. And certainly, our pleasure, our amusement, our palate pleasure, our sense of fashion, that can't be enough. And that's exactly why, by the way, Rebecca, people get very upset when dog fighting issues are discussed. You know, when we had the business in the media with Michael Vick a couple of years ago, and then again in 2009, where people were upset with him, and they were upset. Why were they upset with him? Because people say dog fighting is terrible because it involves imposing pain, suffering, and death for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. And the answer is, really? Well, then how are we any better than the guy who's got the dog fighting ring going on because we sit around roasting the corpses of animals that are treated every bit as badly, if not worse, than Michael Vick's dogs? So you know, it's really sort of a form of moral schizophrenia. We don't really think clearly about this. But if we thought of animals as non-human moral persons, as members of the moral community, the one thing that I can tell you with complete certainty is we would stop eating them altogether. We wouldn't eat their corpses. We wouldn't eat their bodily secretions. We wouldn't eat their eggs. We wouldn't eat any of it.
And I appreciate all of that discussion. That's making so much sense to me. And I thank you for making those arguments. I'm interested in the claim by the new welfarist that somehow the welfare movement would itself lead to abolition.
Well, but there's no... look, we've had animal welfare for the better part of 200 years now. We are using more animals now in more horrific ways than at any point in human history. So this idea that that just talking about animal welfare leads to abolition, there's no empirical evidence for it. Indeed, what there is empirical evidence for is by telling the public that you're improving welfare standards, and I don't think really we're improving them much at all, but, you know, these large organizations have a vested interest in promoting these things as major victories, that when you do that, you make people feel more comfortable about animal exploitation, and I think that that has the effect of making people more comfortable about animal exploitation, and it perpetuates consumption. I mean, look at your case in particular. You thought, you know, you were very aware of the animal issue for a long time. It's not that you were that you weren't conscious about it or thinking about it. What you were doing was, you know, you were drawing an artificial line. What was the artificial line? It was between flesh and other animal products. Why were you drawing that line? Because vegetarianism is promoted by these large organizations as a coherent moral position. I don't believe it is. I mean, I think that there is no distinction between meat and dairy. There's as much, if not more, suffering in a glass of milk than in a pound of steak. The animals are kept alive longer. They're treated every bit as badly. They end up in the same slaughterhouse. So, you know, you're a perfect example of the failure of that, because it took you as long as it took you to sort of see the vegan position. Why? Because, you know, it wasn't a question that you didn't have consciousness about it. It's the question of you weren't thinking in a particular way about it, because you were being told that the interim step you were taking was itself a morally desirable step to take. And the bottom line is, if you tell people that they can discharge their moral obligations to animals by being vegetarians, that's if they care about the issue, that's what they'll do. If you tell them they can discharge their moral obligations by buying happy meat or cage-free eggs or whatever, that's exactly what they'll do. I mean, my view is I talk to people about veganism. If you're not ready to go vegan and you're going to go buy cage-free eggs or happy meat or something like that, that's what you're going to do, but at least you're going to have in the back of your mind the argument I've made to you. And you're not going to have in the back of your mind, by going to buy the cage-free eggs, I'm doing the right thing. This is the morally right thing to do. Because, frankly, I don't really, you know, I think the difference between cage-free eggs and battery eggs, at most, is the difference between being waterboarded on a waterboard that has no padding and a waterboard that has a tiny amount of padding. So I think the differences are very, very slight, if at all. I mean, it's not even clear to me that that cage-free eggs are nothing but one large battery cage, basically. But you know, so I think that we need to be clear in what the moral position is. People are going to do what they're going to do. I talked last night with a group of students, and somebody said, well, what if I'm not ready to go vegan right now? What can I do? And the answer is, look, of course you can go vegan right now, but if you don't want to go vegan right now, then try vegan for a week for breakfast, and you'll see, or 2 weeks, and you'll see that you don't die or go blind or anything, and then you can try it 2 weeks for lunch, and then you can try it 2 weeks for dinner, and then lo and behold, you're a vegan. But, you know, I'm never going to tell people that the morally right thing to do is to buy happy meat or to buy cage-free eggs or to draw an artificial distinction between flesh and dairy, because it's just that. It's an artificial distinction.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Indie Media Live on WRIR. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and I'm talking with Gary Francione, the Distinguished Professor of Law and the Nicholas DeBee Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law. You are the author of numerous books, Gary, and the one we're discussing today is your latest book. You and Robert Garner have written The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Recognition. Regulation. I was struck a second ago when you were talking about the moral personhood of animals, that in this world of ours today, we have declared that corporations are persons.
Yes.
And yet we still look upon animals as chattel property.
Well, when we talk about corporations as being persons or ships, actually ships are also persons. What you basically mean when you that's a legal fiction, and what it means is you've got an entity which can own property, that can sue or be sued, that can, you know, so there are certain attributes of personhood, such as owning property and suing people and being able to be sued, which corporations have. They're entities, they're non-human entities, they're artificial entities, they're legal constructions. But you're correct to say, yeah, that we don't have a problem conceptually saying that these peculiar entities, these non-natural entities, like corporations or like ships, can be regarded as persons for particular purposes. But then we get all, you know, fuddled up and, you know, and whatnot, and we become all confused and say, what does he mean when he says that, you know, that non-human animals can be persons? I want to be clear. I'm not saying that we need to treat them the way we treat non-human persons in all respects, because that would really be dumb. I mean, it would. I'm not suggesting that we need to give, you know, dogs driver's licenses or give animals the right to vote or something like that, although we might end up with better results in our elections if we did. I'm not suggesting that we need to do something like that. What I'm saying that is, for the purpose of being treated as a resource, all sentient beings are equal. That is, if the question is it all right for me to use this unconsenting, non-human, for the purpose of whether or not we're going to use a non-consenting being as a forced organ donor or in a painful biomedical experiment, I see no difference between an intelligent human, an unintelligent human, or any human and a non-human. I mean, they're all equal for that particular purpose, and that's really what I'm talking about. But, you know, once you accept that animals have an interest that should be protected by a right in not being used as a resource, that basically excludes virtually all of our institutional animal use, if not all of it. And so just accepting that one, what I think is a fairly simple proposition, requires a real paradigm shift in how we deal with animals.
And in the last minute that we have, I would just like to throw out one more very heavy subject. Mm-hmm. And I hate to do that with just a few seconds left. But the new welfarist idea of us determining somehow an acceptable level of suffering,
yeah,
for another non-consenting being,
yeah,
was really hard to read.
Well, that's Robert Garner's position, is that animals have, he considers himself a rights person, and that's a whole other issue as to whether or not his position really is a rights position, but assuming for purposes of argument that it is, he's talking about a right not to suffer unacceptably. And as I point out in the book, I don't know what that means, because it seems to me once you start saying that an animal has a right not to suffer unacceptably, you need to give some content to the concept of what acceptability means. And, you know, what is unacceptable suffering? And then that just brings you right back to the balancing of human and non-human interests in terms of figuring out what's humane, what's unnecessary, what's okay. And in that sort of balancing, my point is, because animals are chattel property, their interests are always going to count for less than our interests. So although we purport to be balancing, we're not really balancing at all. They always lose.
Well, I thank you so much for being here today, Professor Francione, and I would just like to tell people that you have a most amazing website and blog, abolitionistapproach.com, and that if our listeners, and I'm sure they will be eager to find out more about this, they can go to abolitionistapproach.com and find out more about you and your work and the ethical value of veganism. All of the information that you've heard today, these websites and Professor Francione's books, will be posted on our blog, indiemedialive.blogspot.com, and this show will be rebroadcast tomorrow on WRIR's live stream from 2:30 until 3:30, 2:30 until 3 o'clock. And Gary, I hope you'll come back in the very near future and help us continue to grapple with this most important fundamental issue.
Absolutely, and I enjoy doing it on your program, because your station, it promotes progressive and important social values, and I really, as you know from my writing, I really see the human rights, animal rights connection as very, very close. I don't look at animal rights as in a vacuum. I see it as very, very much part of our discourse about human rights. As a matter of fact, adjunct professor Charlton and I teach a course at the law school, which we're going to be teaching this afternoon, human rights and animal rights, where we discuss these issues. So, you know, I'm delighted to be on your program because of the you make the connection, we make the connection, and I think it's important for the connection to be made.
Well, thank you so much for all your work, and thank you for being here today. Gary Francione, Distinguished Professor of Law at Rutgers University.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Sunday, March the 13th, there will be a fundraiser for Bradley Manning's defense. It will be held at Bus Boys and Poets in Washington, 2021 14th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Specialist Manning is accused of providing classified documents to WikiLeaks and is being held at Quantico Marine Base in Stafford, Virginia. If you'd like more information about this event, www.busboysandpoets.com. Or you can give them a call, 202-387-7638. We will have all of this information posted also on our blog, indiemedialive.blogspot.com. I would like to tell you also that on Saturday, March the 19th, there will be a rally for peace at noon at Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., following a march on the White House following on the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq as the occupation and U.S. war making continue unabated. The Veterans for Peace and StopTheseWars.org are holding another massive veteran-led civil resistance. This is going to take place at noon, and speakers for the event will include Ralph Nader, Chris Hedges, and Anne Wright. Some of the organizations that are involved include Answer Coalition, Code Pink, Peace Action, War Crimes Times. You can find out more about all of this on our blog, indiemedialive.blogspot.com, or on the websites of some of these organizations. So now I'd like to introduce you to Gary Francione. It's wonderful to have him back with us today. Gary is the Distinguished Professor of Law and the Nicholas DeBoo Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law.